Nicolet Han Nyman has served as senior attorney for the Waterkeeper Alliance, running their campaign to reform the concentrated production of livestock and poultry. In recent years, she has gained a national reputation as an advocate for sustainable food production and improved farm animal welfare. She is the author of Righteous Pork Chop and has written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Huffington Post, and The Atlantic. She lives on a ranch in Northern California with her husband, Bill Nyman, and their two sons. Today, I'm talking with Nicolet about her new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, The Manifesto of an Environmental Lawyer and Vegetarian Turned Cattle Rancher, published by Chelsea Green. Welcome, Nicolet. Your new book.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Your new book only recently came out, but is already causing something of a stir. For years, we've been hearing about how red meat is bad for us. And there's other controversial material in here, too. Tell us something about your book.
Yeah, well, I had the idea in mind for a number of years, because when I was living on the ranch that we live on here in Northern California, and what I was seeing on our ranch and other well-run ranches that I was visiting around the country was in such stark contrast to what I was hearing from the environmental community as far as environmental impacts. And increasingly, I was also coming across more and more material that was really challenging the conventional wisdom about the health issues. And so I really felt someone that had a really legitimate background in science and especially in environmental work really needed to re-examine the question of the impact of cattle on the land and the impact of beef on our health. And that's what this book does. It really re-examines what I think have become sort of assumptions, almost conventional wisdom about those issues.
Yeah. So let's get this out of the way. I'm sure if you haven't been asked already, everybody's probably asking. Nicolet, you're a vegetarian still?
Yes.
Why?
That's true.
Now, after reading this book, I'm trying to figure out why.
Well, the book doesn't argue, and I've never argued personally either, that you have to eat meat. The point of the book is to say, for those people who choose to eat meat, well-raised beef is a good choice. That's the point.
Okay. So are you saying with this book, is all red meat healthy, or is there a difference between one kind or the way the cattle are raised?
Well, the book talks a lot about the specifics of how, a lot of things that are happening in the conventional mainstream beef industry. And it's both a defense of beef and a critique of beef. So there are many practices that I think are very problematic, both for environmental reasons and human health reasons and animal husbandry reasons. And among the things I strongly object to are things such as using growth hormone on beef cattle. Mm. There's no good reason to do that, and there are many reasons not to do that. So I think that's one of the things that should be ended. I also think that there's far too much usage of having animals in confinement and feeding them grain rather than keeping them out on grass as much as possible. My book doesn't argue that you should never, ever feed grain to cattle, but I argue that we should be a grass-based system much more so than we are today. So it produces healthier food, and it's much better from an environmental standpoint.
Okay.
So there are when beef cattle are raised the best way, that produces food that doesn't, where you don't have to worry about the contaminants and the residues in the meat, and also produces food that is very helpful. It has a higher nutritional content, especially meat that is raised entirely on grass. It has more omega-3s. It has higher levels of various vitamins, et cetera. So there are lots of good nutritional reasons, but for me, the most compelling reasons to keep cattle on grass are environmental.
Okay. And statistically, are we eating more or less red meat? There is at least this impression that every American out there is eating steaks and burgers all the time.
Right. That's actually one of the things that I was the most surprised about over the last several years when I began researching this book. Everyone assumes that Americans are eating more meat and more animal fat today than ever. And actually, that is not true at all. The levels over the last few decades have come down quite a bit. Talking about beef specifically, for example, the level of beef consumption has gone down by about 22% over the last few decades. And when you look at it over a longer period, like over the last century, the level is about the same. So whether you're looking, and if you look at all red meats combined, the level of consumption is actually down as well. So it's really an animal fat consumption is down.
Yeah,
over the last
that's
century.
Definitely a so, misconception.
You know, all those
yeah.
things are kind of things people assume to be true but are not true.
And I would imagine that for vegetarians or even just people cutting back on meat, that one of the reasons is that we want to be humane to animals, that we're concerned with animal welfare. Compare the modern slaughterhouse out there to how you raise through that full life and death cycle the cattle on your ranch.
Well, in both of my books, my first book is Righteous Pork Chop, and then mm-hmm. the book Defending Beef, I talk a lot about the way animals are raised today in sort of concentrated, confined situations. This is especially a problem with poultry, turkeys and chickens and pigs. It's less of a problem, and the animal welfare issue is really less of a problem when you're talking about beef cattle. Because even when beef cattle are confined, they're confined to feedlots, which are essentially outdoor environments. Mm-hmm. They're not nearly as crowded as pigs and chickens and turkeys are when they're in buildings. And they at least they get to be outdoors, which it really is a real animal welfare issue. So what I do in both my books is I sort of talk about the history of the way animal raising has changed. And why that's problematic for both the environment and certainly for the animals and the quality of life that they have. There's really no good reason. I mean, we're told again and again that we sort of have to raise animals this way today from the perspective of producing enough food. But again, when you look at the statistics about the numbers of animals, it's really much more a question of the animals being raised in a different way. The number of pigs, for example, is pretty much the same number of pigs today as it was in 1915. Mm-hmm. So people assume we need to have them in these factory farms in order to produce enough pork today. That's really not the case. It's really just more about reducing costs and making it less labor intensive.
I see.
Those are the real reasons why those changes have been made.
Okay. And how does grazing restore ecological balance? Because that's a fascinating part of your book, Defending Beef, as well, is that it you're not only saying that it doesn't harm the environment, you're actually presenting a terrific argument that it's good for our environment.
Yeah, well, I believe very strongly that well-raised animals are not only an acceptable part of the from an ecological standpoint and other standpoints of the food system, I actually believe they're a necessary part of an optimal food system from an ecological standpoint. When you talk about grazing animals in particular, which is what this book, Defending Beef, is focusing on, there are many reasons why grazing animals are very important in the food system. For one thing, we have natural major areas of natural grasslands around the United States. There are some that are human-created, and then there are many that have been there for thousands and thousands of years. And in fact, they existed in prehistoric times, long mm-hmm. before humans even came to the Americas. So grazing animals are absolutely essential for maintaining those areas, keeping them as grasslands, and keeping those ecosystems functioning properly. Grazing animals also have a really important and unique role in diversified farming operations, where you have different crops and different types of things being grown on different fields and those being rotated around on the different land areas, which is probably the most ecological way to farm, because the grazing animals can graze an area after it's been harvested. Or you can have a cover crop that's planted, and then the grazing animals come in and use that as feed and help to recycle the nutrients in those areas. So they have a really important role, whether it's goats or sheep or cattle, but those grazing animals can really be an important role in very ecological farming. So I think we really need the grazing animals. It's not just that they're defensible, they're actually necessary.
What about the arguments of overgrazing or soil erosion?
Well-managed cattle do not cause erosion. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. When you have well-managed cattle on an area, you're going to have far less erosion than almost any other human land use would cause. And I cite a lot of research in the book. The book is very intensive in terms of the research that it presents.
Yes, it is.
And very scientifically based. And many of the studies that I cite show that well-managed grazing actually holds on to soil better than almost anything else you can do, certainly far better than plowing the land. And the reason for that is that well-managed grazing maintains a very dense vegetative cover. And if you think about a grassy area, I mean, a lawn is not a good example from an ecological standpoint because it's really not similar to a grassland. But you can still think about your lawn as far as how densely covered the ground is. And that's also the case in a grassland. And so you'll have very dense vegetation covering the ground, which protects the soils and helps to regenerate the soils. And below ground, grass is about 90% of the plant is below ground on a typical grass plant. And so that's incredibly important as far as maintaining and regenerating healthy soils. So in order to keep those plants and growing and to keep soil regenerating below ground, the grazing is an essential element.
What about pollution, manure emissions? That's a big part of talk about agriculture today as well.
Exactly. Well, again, you know, my background is as an environmental lawyer who specialized in pollution from livestock operations. So mm-hmm. I'm very familiar with that issue. And to me, it's become increasingly clear over the last, you know, 12 years that I've been working on these issues, that that's really a question of how it's done. And when things are done in the best way, the manure is not only not a problem, it's really an asset to an ecosystem and to an agricultural operation. So manure is, you know, good, extremely good, actually, when it's, you know, from well-managed animals. And it's a problem when it's from, you know, a confined feeding operation that has, you know, the modern industrial animal operation has far more manure than it can possibly dispose of in an environmentally responsible way. It's sort of inherently environmentally problematic. That is not at all the case for a well-run grazing operation where the manure is actually very beneficial, returning nutrients to the soils and helping to regenerate the soils and keep the abundant life that happens beneath the ground thriving. So manure is, you know, all about how, you know, how it's handled. It's in a well-run grazing operation, manure is an asset.
And being devil's advocate here, what about watering animals? I just a little while ago heard a report how we're depleting our water supply, getting into groundwater, pumping it out of the ground. And some of the people out there are saying, well, livestock's part of the problem, watering all these animals.
Well, again, you know, with all these issues, there is a seed of truth to it. And certainly when you have confined animal operations, especially pig operations, for example, and dairy operations that are totally confined, are very water intensive mm-hmm. because not only are they watering the animals, but they're also using a lot of liquid to flush the manure and to keep the manure in a liquid form. So, you know, there are good reasons to examine the water usage with respect to livestock. There's no doubt about that. But when you have grazing animals on grass, on pasture or on natural grasslands or rangelands, it's not actually a very intensive use of water because the animals, for one thing, they get the majority of their water from the grass itself, and they actually return the vast majority of the moisture right back into the ecosystem through their urine and through their manure. And so it's recycled right back into the system. And I actually cite the other thing that's important when you talk about beef cattle specifically. I cite a very, very exhaustive study that was done on that issue by University of California at Davis, which is an excellent agricultural school. And they looked at exactly how much water was used in a typical pound of beef. And they found that it was just slightly more than what would be used in a typical pound of rice. So it's not that beef is not somewhat water intensive. It is. But it is certainly not such an outlier. There are many foods that are commonly consumed that use a lot of water. They include coffee, chocolate, sugar, rice. And so all of these things are things that we need to be thinking about in the future when we're designing, you know, optimal agricultural systems. But suggesting that beef are somehow, you know, so much water intensive than other foods is just false.
All right. And bee colonies, there's another issue that's being talked about a great deal today, and that's colony collapse for the bees. You make even a connection there in your book. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, there was a very interesting study. Of course, you know, the bees are being researched all over the world.
Right.
And one of the leading experts on this issue, Dr. Claire Kremen, is at UC Berkeley here, not far from where we live. And she actually did with a team of researchers, they did an analysis of the wild pollinators in the state of California. And they discovered that as much as 40% of the pollination that was happening on the crops of California, so the things that are actually being grown on fields, they're being planted and harvested, that pollination, up to 40% of that was happening from wild pollinators. Now, the reason why that's so important is because the bees are disappearing. The domesticated bees are increasingly challenged. There are, you know, various different theories about why that's happening all over the world. But we know that it is happening. And so these wild pollinators are incredibly important. And it turns out that the primary habitat for those wild pollinators is on rangeland. In other words, grasslands that are being grazed by cattle and other grazing animals. So the reason that's so important is you have to have a place for these pollinators to live. And actually, ideally, you want them near the areas where you have other types of agriculture happening as well, because then the wild pollinators can come and live on those areas, and then they can go and pollinate them. It's really hard for a pollinator, a bee or other insects that do pollination, it's hard for them to live on a typical plowed farm field. But rangelands, natural grasslands, tend to be left undisturbed, and so the bees and many other forms of wildlife can find very good homes there and be there, you know, indefinitely over generation after generation on the same piece of ground. And so it works well for lots of wildlife, including the wild pollinators.
So what about world hunger? That's yet another argument that we hear is, can we feed the planet on plants? How realistic is that?
Well, that issue, you know, there's been a lot of analysis of that. There was actually a big study that was done by a European think tank a few years ago that looked at how much meat and dairy you could produce for the world if you kind of got rid of factory farms. And they also looked at what about if you converted to totally organic agriculture and got rid of the chemicals. And they found that with just slight reductions in the diet in the Western world, as far as meat and dairy, because the Western world, you know, the United States and many westernized countries, consumes a lot more meat and dairy than the developing world.
Yeah.
And so they found that if there was just a slight reduction in that, you could actually easily satisfy the demands, the global demands for meat and dairy. And interestingly, that's kind of already happening. You know, we talked about earlier the fact that beef consumption has declined by 22% in the United States over the last few decades. That's happening all over the Western world. People are reducing their meat and dairy consumption a little bit. So the point is, it can be done. And in the United States, the Savory Institute has looked at how much beef you could produce if you had all of the cattle on grass. And they found that actually there was a surplus of land to do that, because if you adopted really well-managed grazing practices, you actually can produce far more beef per acre. So we actually have more than enough land to raise the beef that's needed for the United States and for the world.
And cholesterol, heart disease, that was another section of your book that I found fascinating. We have heard for such a long time that cholesterol has this connection to heart disease. You tell a completely different story there.
Yeah, it started, you know, that whole idea started in the 1950s and 60s, and it sort of became increasingly the accepted wisdom in the healthcare and the public health community. And there's actually a lot of evidence to contradict that. And I sort of trace the history of how it became sort of universally accepted that red meat and animal fat was connected to chronic diseases. And I show that actually that is probably not the case, and that actually there are other things in the American diet and in the westernized diet around the world that is leading to these chronic problems. And I especially argue that sugar is most likely the leading culprit.
You were something of a sugar addict, weren't you?
Well, I remember as a child, I always had to have, you know, and all through college, mm-hmm. I always had to have some candy in my backpack. You know, I was one of those kind of people who really, I mean, I like sugar a lot. So it's been, for me, you know, I've been, as an adult, I've always made an effort to eat less sugar because it just seemed like a good idea.
Yeah.
But since doing the research for this book, I have really turned off from sugar because there's very credible evidence that everything from high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, and even heart disease are much more closely linked to sugar consumption than to animal fat or red meat consumption.
That would explain a lot of what we're seeing in trends in this country.
Well, absolutely. You know, the sugar consumption has risen so dramatically.
Yeah.
And really, what's very interesting that I haven't really thought about until I did the research for this book is that up until around 1800, you know, which is not that long of a time period when you think about the long history of, you know, humans on the earth.
Yeah.
Up until about that time, humans had very little sweetness at all in their diet. It really was limited to ripe fruits and a little bit of honey. Most humans didn't have much access to honey.
Yeah.
And even though sugar production started, it was known how to create sugar for more than 2,000 years. But still, it was very rare because it was so expensive to do. So most people around the globe didn't have any sweetness in their diet other than ripe fruit until the last couple hundred years. And when you start thinking about that, it really puts a different perspective on sort of modern health problems. Red meat, in contrast to that, though, we've been eating since probably about 2.5 million years. So when you start thinking about some of that, I think it really reshapes the dialogue as far as, you know, what have our bodies evolved with and for? And I believe that we have evolved to eat a certain amount of meat. We have not evolved to eat sugar.
A lot of common sense there, too, as you read it. The pieces just fall into place and make sense. So when we go to the grocery store, what should we look in terms of labeling? What's the right beef to choose?
Well, honestly, I think people are best served by trying to get out of their grocery stores as much as possible. The best foods, you know, whether you're talking about meat or dairy or eggs or vegetables, are really not available in the grocery stores. As much as possible, people should try to buy directly from farmers, whether it's from farm stands or CSAs, which are, you know, where you sort of buy a share of a farm, a farm's produce, or farmers markets. There are lots of ways to get at that, much more directly get at foods from your farmer, and to try to buy as much as possible from your local community. To the extent that you have to shop in a grocery store for, you know, lack of time or convenience or whatever, you really, to the greatest extent possible, when you're talking about dairy and eggs and meat, you should try to find it coming from animals that were raised on grass. That really
so grass fed is one of those things that we want to look for, and what, GMO free?
I don't talk about the GMO issue much in either book, But we have made our own feed for our animals is GMO free.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we decided to do that was because there was enough evidence that it may cause problems, health problems for the animals, and perhaps even for humans that are consuming that. So we decided rather than running the possibility of that, we wanted to use the most healthful feed. So I do think GMO-free is a good thing to look for, although there's obviously a lot of scientific debate about that. But grass, to me, is the number one most important thing for food.
Okay.
And when you're buying your fruits and vegetables directly from a local farm, you're going to get much more nutrient-dense food because it's going to it won't have been sitting in a refrigerated truck or a warehouse for months on end. So, you know, try to get food from your local community and try if it's for eggs, dairy, and milk and meat. Try to get food from animals that were actually outside and preferably on grass. That's the best of all.
You talk about the loss of the traditional family farm in your book, and I think a lot of non-farming people would see that almost as a romantic ideal, perhaps. But you have some solid things to say there, too, that it's more than just this romantic idea of a farm.
You know, it's much more, first of all, there's a huge interest in people that are kind of 40 and below in agriculture and in being part of food production. And I've seen this all over the country. There's a tremendous interest in among younger people in sort of reclaiming the food system from the sort of industrialized model that it's gone to over the last few decades. So the biggest problem that has existed as far as the disappearance of the family farms and ranches over the last couple of decades has been that loss of human power. But there really is a tremendous resurgence and interest in that. And I think that the more consumer demand that there is for it, that fosters and supports that interest and that, you know, the creation of opportunity for young people to go into it. So a lot of we've been involved with things, my husband and I have been involved with things in various parts of the country, trying to connect young farmers up with land that they can use for, for farming on, even if they're not owning it themselves, and also just helping to create more opportunities for young farmers to learn and then to begin their own farms. But it's really not a romantic vision. I mean, we have an unemployment problem. We have young people who want to farm. We need to create opportunities for young people on farms.
Yeah.
And if those opportunities are there, I am absolutely positive that young people are going to be wanting to fill those positions. And each of us can support that by seeking out the food from those local farms.
So where can people learn more about you, about your ranch, about your books, both of them, Righteous Pork Chop and Defending Beef? Are you planning any trips to Kalamazoo anytime soon?
I am talking to some people in the Kalamazoo area about coming there, and hopefully I'll be doing something with the libraries and with Kalamazoo College, and that is still in the works. So I don't have a date for that, but people should look for that. Keep their eyes open. I always love coming to Kalamazoo more than any place else because it's still my hometown. I've got a website, NicoletteHahnNyman.com, that has a link to a lot of my writings. There's a Facebook page, especially for the book Defending Beef, which is just Defending Beef. And our ranch has a website as well, which is called eatlikeitmatters.com. Mm. And that's mostly just information and photographs about what we do. You can't even order food from there, but it's just a way of showing people what we do and talking about what we do. So there are several places people can look.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for taking time to talk with us today, Nicolette. We appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.